I'm Chris Boyd, and this is Think Again, Think's weekly recap show where we revisit some of my favorite conversations of the week. On this week's episode, how the trajectory of a U.S. senator's life was permanently altered in an instant.
I looked at pictures of all sorts of feet until I found ones that looked like what mine were, and then I said those, and they made them look exactly like that for me. You can paint and the toenails, you can do all of that. And I don't wear them, because when I wear them and I look in the mirror, I see what I lost.
And what a man found out about himself by running thousands of miles.
We lived in this sort of fragmented reality that needed to be whole again. And it was, for me at least, I needed to bring that story whole as best as I could. Otherwise, we would continue to be dispossessed and displaced in our own story. And I couldn't accept that.
Some of my favorite moments from those conversations up next. How much do you know about your senators? And I don't mean how much do you know about their policies or political beliefs, but about their personal histories, about what drove them to shape our nation. If you're like me, probably not a whole lot beyond the headlines. So when we got a book in the mail from a current U.S. senator, I was curious enough to give it a read. What I learned was surprisingly insightful, maybe even inspirational.
I couldn't carry my own weight. I could fly the aircraft just fine with the prosthetic limbs, but I could never carry a wounded buddy and evacuate him. I'd be challenged just to get myself to safety. And so I was adrift with no mission. How do I serve my country? There's no mission. What can I do? And Dick Durbin said, here's a mission for you. Take care of vets. Run for Congress. And that's how I got into politics.
Tammy Duckworth represents Illinois in the U.S. Senate and previously served in the House of Representatives, also as Assistant VA Secretary. She's the recipient of a Purple Heart. She joined me this week to share her life story, which she writes about in her book, Every Day is a Gift, a Memoir. Let's listen to some of that conversation. Senator, you come from a long line of people who have served in the military, I think dating back to the Revolutionary War, but you hadn't really considered a military career yourself. What led you to sign up for ROTC when you were in grad school?
I got laid off from a job and I needed a way to make a little bit of money. And I also was studying to become an ambassador because that was my childhood dream. I knew I wanted to serve my country. My dad instilled that in all of us. We always assumed it would be my younger brother as the boy who would serve in the military. He's the one who took all the junior ROTC classes in high school. And I was going to join the Foreign Service and serve as a Foreign Service officer stamping passports in an embassy somewhere. And so the Berlin Wall was coming down. I was watching, people flee Eastern Europe like I watched people flee Cambodia. And all of these images were fresh in my mind. And then I had these classmates at George Washington University who are veterans or currently serving who said, Tammy, well, this is the field you want to go into, Foreign Service. You have to learn something about America's military power. Why don't you just take this, go off to basic training this summer? You've been laid off anyway. You need to make a little bit of money. They won't let you spend money there that you earn because you'll be in basic training and you'll learn something about the military and come back and, maybe take one or two ROTC classes and that'll be it. And then you'll be a better Foreign Service officer. And that sounded like a good idea to me. So I went off to cadet basic training in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and I fell in love with the Army like no one ever fell in love with the Army before.
What did you love about it?
I love that it was a pure meritocracy. There I was, at Fort Knox, miserable. I think I write that I actually locked myself in the latrines and cried many times while the drill sergeants were yelling at me. But it didn't matter that I was a little mixed-race, half-Asian, half-white girl. It only mattered if I could shoot straight or was at least willing to learn to shoot straight. It only mattered if when you're on a road march, the guy next to you, his rucksack gets too heavy for him. Do you step forward to help him carry it? That's all that mattered. The Army, to get respect from your fellow soldiers in the Army, you just have to pull your own weight and be willing to be part of the team and put something and then serve something bigger than yourself, the United States of America. And I love that pure meritocracy. And I knew I was a goner before basic training was done. I knew I was going to be in, and do at least 20 years.
What personality traits do helicopter pilots tend to share?
So one of the tests is actually a personality test. In the in the aptitude test. And I describe this, I say, so they want risk takers. They want people who, you know, one of the questions was, do you like to ride motorcycles? And the questions, there's no wrong answer, but the answers are like, no, never. They're way too dangerous. Or yes, I like to go, you know, I like to ride like a bat out of hell, go as fast as I can. Or I love, you know, to ride motorcycles. I like the speed, but I always wear my full safety gear because it is inherently dangerous. So they want you to answer like the third answer gets you the most points because they want people who are risk takers, but also not idiots. Mm.
You don't remember anything about your rescue and evacuation after the helicopter you were in was shot down. So you went back and talked with other people who did have memories of that day. I wonder how you prepared yourself for flooding your brain with stories that were so traumatic that your brain had not remembered them in the first place.
Well, I did not remember them because the kindness of the doctors and nurses at the CASH, the Combat Surgical Hospital, like a MASH, but a CASH, it doesn't move around. It's a permanent building, so it's called a CASH, at the CASH in Baghdad. They gave me a drug when they intubated me and put me under for my first set of surgeries that they knew would wipe out my memory, my short-term memory. And they did that for every soldier going, Marine airman going through there as a way to protect us from the very bad memories. And so I didn't remember any of that. And I had been told a lot of it from my crewmates who saved me that day. But it was emotional in writing the book and going through and talking to the doctors and nurses that I'd never met who took care of me that day. And it also, for me, was coming full circle because of a lot of the things that they were telling me, things that I said and did that for a soldier reaffirmed that I did everything that I could in terms of carrying out my duties as a soldier and looking out after the my buddies, the men that I outranked.
You wouldn't stop asking about your guys even as they were trying to get you into surgery.
Yeah, in doing the book, I met the nurse who intubated me. And it's really interesting because he said to me, I've been waiting to talk to you to tell you this story because it has haunted me for the last 15 years since I took care of you. And what he said was, I was talking to him, I was in shock, but I was still talking to him and I refused to acknowledge that I was, I just kept saying, how are my men? How are my men? Take care of my men. And just as he was about to intubate me, he said to me, I write this, and it's in detail in the book. It's a quote from him that says, as he was about to put me under, he said, ma'am, we're going to put you to sleep. The next time you wake up, you're either being launched to Germany or Walter Reed, and you won't remember any of this. And I grabbed him by the scrubs, pulled him up again to next to my face and said, you better take care of my men. Hmm. And for me, as a soldier, as an officer, that's the proudest moment of my life, to know that until what could have been my last words, I was doing my job. But for him, being able to tell me that and know that I was okay was also equally important because it allowed him to put to rest a lot of the bad memories he's had and deal with the trauma that he experienced to know somebody that he treated who ended up surviving and doing well, that his work was worth it.
When did you realize that your body would never be the same?
Oh, I mean, I knew when my husband went out of my ICU room and put in the doctor and the two of them came to tell me that, no, my feet don't actually hurt. I actually have no feet. I have no legs. So I knew that my body would never be the same, but I did not know that my life would not be the same. I was determined to go back to my unit, just like every other, you know, if you ask any other troop laying in a hospital bed who is wounded in service, what do you want to do, soldier? What do you want to do, Marine? Every single one of them will say the same thing. I want to go back to my unit, sir. I want to go back to my unit, ma'am. When can I go? Strap those artificial legs on me. I'm ready to go back. And I felt tremendous guilt for being safe at Walter Reed while my buddies were still downrange. And this, you know, I was wounded during the second battle for Fallujah. So my buddies were still facing dangers. And I just felt that it was fundamentally unfair that I was safe and they were not.
You were given a prosthetic leg that looked like a woman's leg. It matched what your legs had looked like before. And you actually preferred the one made out of titanium that is not pretending to be anything other than what it is. Why is that?
Yeah. You know, I've talked about this with other folks. They're called cosmetic legs. Inside they have the titanium, but they're covered with an artificial padding and an artificial skin that an artist actually paints from the inside on the reverse side. So when you look at them, you can touch and feel that it feels like legs. It looks like legs. It looks like my skin. They actually took pictures of my skin tone on my arm. They matched my freckles perfectly. Mm-hmm. They made the second toes longer than the big toe, like my feet had been. I looked at pictures of all sorts of feet until I found ones that looked like what mine were. And then I said those, and they made them look exactly like that for me. You can paint and the toenails, you can do all of that. And I don't wear them because when I wear them and I look in the mirror, I see what I lost. I see the legs that I lost, and I have to go through a grieving process and a loss again, as opposed to when I wear my titanium legs. They are nothing but strength, and they symbolize my loss, but they're also strength for me. And I prefer wearing my metal legs because they really reflect who I am now.
Senator, what did Senator Dick Durbin have to do with your decision to enter the field of politics?
Dick found me. Dick, Senator Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois in 2005, was a senior senator to Barack Obama, the newly elected junior senator from Illinois, who also served on the Veterans Affairs Committee. But Dick, that year in 2005, every year since, he has invited military men and women to take his two tickets to the State of the Union address and be his guest every year. Other senators give it to friends, family members, lobbyists, different folks. But Dick Durbin, every year, gives his two tickets, two seats to our troops, especially our wounded warriors. And that year in 2005, he called out to Walter Reed and said, do you have any wounded warriors from Illinois who are well enough to come to the State of the Union? I was one of two. I was marginally well enough to go. And it was actually only 10 weeks after my shoot down. And we weren't sure if I could make it, but I was determined to go. And so I got to go to the State of the Union and watch President George W. Bush give his State of the Union address. And it was awe-inspiring to be in the U.S. Capitol, to meet all the senators, and to really just see the rituals of this democracy that I just lost my legs defending. It was really moving for me. But it also meant that I got to meet both Dick Durbin and Barack Obama. And Dick Durbin gave me his personal cell phone number on the back of a card. I've since asked him, like, why did you do that? He goes, well, I thought it was important. There was only two of you from Illinois, you know? So he said it wasn't going to be a big deal. But I happened to be the highest ranking amputee at Walter Reed for about 6 to 8 months. And we had a lot of problems there, not with the healthcare. The healthcare was above the best, but basically, you know, the Bush administration at the time wasn't ready for so many wounded to come back from the war. They expected the war to be over in 2 weeks. Remember, Donald Rumsfeld said they'll meet us in the streets with flowers and chocolates, mm-hmm. and we'll be done in 2 weeks. And this was, you know, well over 2 years on. And Walter Reed was just swamped. And we had problems like a soldier who wasn't getting paid, or a soldier who had his mother there, but his wife couldn't come because the Army would only let one person come because there just wasn't enough room. My mother and my husband, for example, slept on the floor of the intensive care unit living room, waiting for a room to open up that they could actually stay in the quarters, and along with a whole bunch of other family members. And so I just started abusing the privilege of Dick Durbin's phone number. And I started calling him, like, I got a guy here from Texas, or I got a guy here from Arkansas or from Illinois. And he became the unofficial ombudsman for Walter Reed, and he solved every problem that I sent his way. And then Barack Obama asked me to testify before the Veterans Affairs Committee in the Senate, based on me calling Dick and bothering him so much. And then after 10 months, Dick Durbin called me and said to me, Tammy, if you think we haven't taken care of veterans and we're not doing right by our servicemen and women, you need to run for Congress. And he blew my mind. And he caught me at a sort of critical time for me when I realized, had just realized that I wasn't going to get to fly helicopters again. I would be allowed to serve, but I just was not deployable. I couldn't carry my weight. You know, going back to what I said about falling in love with the Army, I couldn't carry my own weight. I could fly the aircraft just fine with the prosthetic limbs, but I could never, you know, carry a wounded buddy and evacuate him. I'd be challenged just to get myself to safety. And so I was adrift with no mission. How do I serve my country? There's no mission. What can I do? And Dick Durbin said, here's a mission for you. Take care of vets, run for Congress. And that's how I got into politics.
Senator Tammy Duckworth's new book is called Every Day is a Gift, a Memoir. When is the last time you thought you'd head out and run a few miles? That's not too uncommon, especially during pandemic times, but what about running a few thousand miles? If you've never had the desire, don't worry, you are not alone. But one of my guests this week set out to do just that.
What I knew would keep me going were the stories that I would carry, which were my parents' stories, my mom's stories, right? Every day was a different reason for running.
Noé Álvarez is a first-generation American who set off to find out who he was and to honor his family and ancestral roots by running a Native American event stretching from Canada to Guatemala. He chronicled his experience and reflected on that journey to make the run in his book Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. Let's hear what he had to say. So help us understand peace and dignity journeys. Broadly speaking, what is the purpose of running for 6 months and who goes?
So the goal of peace and dignity journeys was to visit with indigenous communities, build relationships, and engage in ceremony with them. It was essentially to get us to move again. It was to take action for our lives and to build momentum around running and carrying your community forward. So we ran with feathered staffs that symbolized the thousands of prayers and stories of indigenous communities we connected with, you know, and these feathers represented very specific things that people wanted us to carry on the run, like the death of a loved one, incarcerated youth, drug addiction, decimated landscapes, many heavy things. And so these feather staffs really symbolize the indigenous nations of North, Central, and South America. And as we ran and the run progressed, we sort of weaved through these communities and bearing the weight of all these experiences and learning how to work with the staffs, learning how to work with ourselves, and properly honoring these stories, you know, wherever we went. And so that's what it was. It was people who came from very different walks of life who agreed that running was going to be the medium by which we had our conversations, by which we we're going to heal, and by which we were going to have a conversation. That was what brought us together. And it happens every 4 years, this run. And so that means that we ourselves are saying this work is never done. It's a work in progress. It's hard work, but we had to come together routinely in this kind of ceremony of running, of talking with people in your community, in your neighborhood, and putting in that work. Because if you don't, you know, it's change is not going to happen. And so yeah, that's essentially what Peace and Dignity Journeys is about.
What did you know before you started about the physical challenges of the run? And were you confident that you were up to them before you started?
I didn't know much. I did know that there was going to be a lot of work. I knew that I would succeed insofar as I was already raised with the hard work, right? I told myself that if I just committed myself like my dad and my mom did to the work that they do, that I could do it. And but I was nervous deep down inside. I was scared of you know, bringing shame to them. I was scared of failing at yet another thing because college clearly didn't work out for me, and that was all that we were counting on. And here I was just saying, I'm going to drop it and do this run. But what I knew would keep me going were the stories that I would carry, which were my parents' stories, my mom's stories, right? Every day was a different reason for running. And I had a lot of trauma, a lot of anger for a lot of things. I had a lot of emotions that I needed to dislodge within me that were affecting me really badly. And so I needed to do this. I had no other choice. And I bought a one-way ticket, so I had no other choice but to keep running.
Did your parents understand when you told them you wanted to drop out of school and do this for the better part of a year?
I would like to say that they, deep down, they did. At least my dad did, right? My dad had done it himself. You know, people before him have done it. All the men just leave, the women, and that's just the thing. And so he was pretty quiet when I had sort of told him and my mother. And my mother wasn't happy. Obviously, she was really counting on me to be in college. And I tried to sugarcoat it. And I told her that I was going on vacation and I was going to be staying in hotels and that things were going to be good. And only afterwards did I tell that when I told her what really happened, she slapped me around a little bit and told me, what did you do? You know, and so, but my dad, I think he saw it coming, you know, and he was pretty quiet about it. So, but I had to do it. And I think he understood that I really wanted to sort of figure out where I came from, figure out what it is that it was that made us migrants, what it meant to be a mover, what it meant to be a migrant, what it meant to be a traveler. And I wanted to sort of find its power and I wanted to carry it with me. I didn't want to have shame around running because I had fear, you know, of running, you know, all my life. I wanted to sort of take back what that meant. You know, I wanted to destroy this belief that running was a bad thing, right? I was accustomed to running from, you know, gangs, you know, and then our people, from border agents, from our past, danger in general, right? So I just sort of wanted to sort of, you know, free my family from this narrative that running was a bad thing. I wanted to bring it back and say, look, this is good for us. If you have the privilege like I do, there's magic in this, and I needed to tap into that.
What did you know about your own Indigenous heritage when you decided to take this on?
Not much, right? And that's the thing, is that there's a lot of fragments in that, you know, fragmentation in migration. When people leave and migrate, you know, from Mexico, they often, you know, leave stories behind, right? They often have to sort of discard certain things that they think shouldn't be shared with us, their kids, that they don't want to pass on to us. But we know as kids, right? We see it in our parents' eyes. We feel the impact of and the toll emotionally that it has on my parents and migrants when they have to leave their families behind. So there's a lot of stories that my parents wouldn't share, couldn't share, didn't know, right? Because they didn't have that privilege. My dad grew up homeless in Mexico, right? And so he didn't have access to a lot of his narrative, a lot of his story. And I think it was sort of, you know, killing us. And so story was literally going to be the only thing that would heal us. And so I wanted to go down to his lands and my mom's lands and find out and ask those questions that they couldn't afford to ask, weren't ready to ask. And so for me, I knew of the heritage of the regions that we were from, the people who came over, and it was fragmented, right? And so we lived in this sort of fragmented reality that needed to be whole again. And it was, for me at least, I needed to bring that story whole as best as I could. Otherwise we would continue to be dispossessed and displaced in our own story. And I couldn't accept that. It wasn't working for me, especially as a first generation out here in the United States. I've been accustomed to living in this middle world, and it was destroying me, right? And I needed to find a framework for confronting difficult things in life. And I found running to be that thing for me to sort of fall back on, and that thing that will always give me strength and medicine.
So when you first arrived and joined the group, I have to tell you, I was expecting for the story to start with you being welcomed with open arms and treated really kindly, and that was not your experience. What happened at that point?
Just one of the many, you know, expectations that one can have in life, and you just met with the opposite. And I put that stuff in the book because I wanted to show the reality of our communities, right? That our communities are fragmented, and that there's a lot of work that we need to do within ourselves. I was met with you know, mixed reception, right? I was seen as this outsider, and I knew that I had to prove myself, not with words, but with my body. I had to put in the miles. I was committed to putting in the work. I wanted to earn my place, and I knew that I had to earn my place in a community that, you know, for good reason, had to protect themselves, right? We, in the marginalized communities, protect ourselves. We've been exploited. There's been a lot of trauma, and so there's suspicion about anyone that they don't know to guard yourself against. And so I understood that. But it was a bit of a shock at first, right? I sort of maybe romanticized this idea of what it was going to be to live with the same people for 6 months, you know? We come from different walks of life, East LA, Arctic Village, Mexico. We all had different understandings of what it meant to be a runner, what it meant to be indigenous, what it meant to be Latinx, you know? It meant we had different understandings, and running was the language that would kind of sort of resolve that a little bit. But I put that in the book because I wanted to show that. I wanted to write an honest story, right? I wanted to show that not everything has a resolution, not everything is pretty, but look, we're putting in the work, and that's what matters, you know? And I didn't want to sort of lie to people that things are always going to be easy. They're not. And so for us, the journey was just merely going on, and that's how it is in life. Every day is, you know, we take it one day at a time, and it's going to be a messy process, but as long as you're willing to put in the work, that's what accounts, where it counts. And so, That's where I started, and that we say on the run that running was the easy part. It really was. It was really learning how to, engage with the communities, how to engage with the runners. It was really how to engage with yourself and regulate your own emotions and your own past and your own traumas and trying to fit in to everyone else. And so. A lot to juggle on the run, beyond just physicality.
What sort of connection did you make to the terrain you ran through?
Oh, it was a spiritual, magical experience for me. It definitely recalibrated my spirit, my heart. It was a chance for me to sort of love myself again and fully immerse myself in what I always knew would heal me in nature without harming it, without, you know, feeling like I had any power over it, you know, like in the orchards or whatever, like how we do as a general society where we want to just decimate everything we see. And so it was a chance to just be at peace and surrender to what it offered you. That meant whatever animals you encountered, whatever came out of these woods, you know, you came secondary. You sort of took your lesson from nature, and we ran through all sorts of different terrains, ran in all weather and all rain, slept in all weather and all rain. And so we sort of had to sort of come to peace with nature. And it gave me the tranquility that I needed in my life at the time and that I still need, and it still helps. I found magic, and that was one of the main reasons I continued to run despite all the pain, right? We were literally trying to run to see the next, you know, site. We were running through sacred communities. And we were literally running to the next story. I wanted to run to the next elder to hear the next story he had or she had to share with me about what they were struggling with and what knowledge they wanted to pass on. And so I was running to find my education every day. And so at the expense of my knees.
Noe Alvarez's new book is called Spirit Run, a 6,000-mile marathon through North America's stolen land. Thanks for listening to this episode, highlighting some of my favorite moments of the week. I do hope these conversations make you think about the world around you in a new way. And if you enjoyed them, you can find longer versions in our podcast feed. Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofar Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sri Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.